Good afternoon. This is 91.3 FM KUAF in Fayetteville, a listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas. And this is Ozarks at Large for Thursday, October 8th, 2020. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. On today's show, examining the legacy of the United Daughters of the Confederacy. Two University of Arkansas students are researching the history of the UDC in Northwest Arkansas. And in this week's edition of Sound Perimeter, we learn how the bicycle has inspired composers from around the world. Coming up after Ozarks at Large on Here and Now, the image of 20,000 empty black chairs near the White House over the weekend is a striking reminder of just some of the many lives that have been lost to COVID-19. Nea Cuspa lost her father just 2 weeks ago, and she worries Americans are becoming numb. She responds to President Trump's urging the public not to be afraid. That's next time on Here and Now. Today at 1, right after Ozarks at Large. The Arkansas Department of Health reported another record-breaking day for COVID-19 hospitalizations Wednesday. An additional 9 Arkansans have been hospitalized, bringing the state's total to 538. That's the highest number of hospitalizations since the pandemic began. According to ADH, there are 684 confirmed new cases and 125 new probable cases. The state's cumulative confirmed and probable case count is now 88,880. Of the confirmed new cases, 63 were in correctional facilities. The top 5 counties with the most new cases are Craighead County with 60, Pulaski County with 57, Jefferson County with 44, Washington County with 26, and Sebastian County with 23. In an official statement, Governor Asa Hutchinson said there seems to be a pattern of increased cases toward the latter part of the week as many people go in for testing after a weekend. If the trend holds, he said cases may again increase before declining. However, he said he hopes to keep the peak this week lower than last week and is asking everyone to do their part. ADH also reported another 16 confirmed deaths. There have now been 1,337 confirmed deaths due to the virus. There are also 5,908 confirmed active cases across the state and 778 probable active cases. Greenwood High School, Freshman Center, and Junior High are pivoting to online instruction today and tomorrow. According to district officials, the decision was made in collaboration with the Arkansas Departments of Health and Education. The transition to online instruction is also due to the large number of teachers in quarantine and a shortage of substitute teachers. The district is using this time to thoroughly clean buildings and allow for staff quarantines to expire. Greenwood Pre-K Center, Westwood Elementary, East Point Elementary, and East Hills Middle School will continue their normal daily schedules. Northwest Arkansas Black Lives Matter organizer Aaron William Clark is running for a seat on the Rogers City Council against longtime incumbent Mark Krueger. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich reports.
Aaron William Clark, who's resided intermittently in Northwest Arkansas over the past decade, has garnered national media attention for his Black Lives Matter organizing work this summer, staging mass protests as well as picnics where he's invited white nationalists to join him. His stated goal and name of his organization is Bridge the Gap. Now he's running for a political office, Ward 1, Position 2, Rogers City Council, with no educational or political credentials.
I grew up in the inner city streets, so like all of my family was either getting put in penitentiary for life or dying from gang violence or gun violence. So like I had it in my head, it was just like someone was telling me, they're like, get out of here. Like you're gonna be dead or you're gonna be in prison.
On his campaign website, BioSketch Clark, who was adopted, says, due to family violence, left home, where he says he faced starvation and discrimination. An encounter with a traveling magazine salesman landed him a door-to-door sales job in Kansas City, Missouri. He later made his way to the Ozarks, where he now works as a social change organizer.
A lot of rallies on the, we did a dialogue on the square. We did a cookout down in Harrison where we offered the whole community food. We did a cookout where the head of the KKK, national director of the KKK, Thomas Robb, lives. We want to bridge the gap in the community. We want to bridge racial tensions. We want to bridge the gap between law enforcement and citizens.
Clark's campaign seeks expanded public health resources for working poor, as well as equal pay and criminal justice reform.
So my plan is cooperative community enforcement. So they take money that is in the existing health funds, and they also try to reach into the CARES allocated monies, and we create a special response unit in Rogers, Arkansas. What this special response unit would consist of is basically social workers, counselors, or therapists that are paired up with the police officers, or a special response unit that goes to mental health calls, well-being checks, suicide calls, some domestic calls that aren't violent, that voices are raised, calls for homeless people hanging out. Different things like this could take a lot of pressure off of our police officers.
The city of Rogers counts around 68,000 residents, one-fifth are Hispanic. With a growing population of Asian, Pacific Islanders, and African Americans, yet city council is comprised of all white people.
We have to break that cycle. I think that we have to force the city to acknowledge that. Like, when has there ever been a black city council member? Has there ever been a minority representation on the city council in Rogers?
Rogers, at the turn of the 20th century, was a sundown town where African Americans were not welcome to stay after dark. Blacks, however, were able to settle in Bentonville, Fayetteville, and Eureka Springs, although subject to Jim Crow segregation and violence. Clark is running against incumbent Mark Krueger. The retired vice principal at Rogers High School has served on city council for 32 years. He moved to Northwest Arkansas in 1973.
Well, we try to represent everybody as equally as possible. At the same time, these elections are open to anyone that qualifies to run. And I'm trying to recall, but I think we've had one minority person run in all the 32 years I've been here, been doing this. So, it would be good if you had equal representation based on the population, but in Rogers, as in other cities, that's not always the way it works out.
Krueger acknowledges the importance of the Black Lives Matter movement.
We probably have 2% or less of the black population. It's very important, but it's not as significant as it is in, say, Little Rock or Fort Smith. But we welcome diversity and try to represent everybody equally.
Krueger says police reform should be decided by local law enforcement.
Well, I leave that to our police chief and department. They have an outstanding record in as far as any aspect of policing.
Krueger currently chairs Rogers Advertising and Promotion Commission. His priority is providing sustainable development to accommodate growth in Rogers. Many towns and cities in Northwest Arkansas are seeing unprecedented development, including to accommodate a new remote workforce during the pandemic.
I think if you looked at the record, Rogers has probably led in the efforts for affordable housing for the past several years compared to most of the surrounding communities.
Several years ago, voters during a special election in Rogers approved a multi-million dollar bond issue, extending a 1% sales tax to improve local parks, streets, as well as police and fire station facilities. And when a global pandemic was announced last March, Krueger says the city did take action eventually to protect residents.
we were not quite as fast as Fayetteville, but we shut down quite a bit also, and we followed the CDC and governor's guidelines, and we also have a mask ordinance. So, you know, I think we're doing what we can. Certainly, you know, we need to keep repeating the message over and over again, but at this point, I kind of feel like a lot of it is up to the individual.
Kruger says he doesn't have a campaign agenda, nor a campaign website, instead relying on his enduring record.
I would say, you know, and I've had some other interviews, and they say, why do you think you're the best candidate and whatever? And I would like to say that, you know, I certainly have experience at this point. I think I've developed leadership skills. And in this particular instance, I am not running with any kind of directed cause other than to serve the people of Rogers.
The deadline to request an absentee ballot this presidential election is Tuesday, October 27th. Absentee ballots must be received by mail at county clerk's offices or dropped off in person by 7:30 p.m. on Election Day, Tuesday, November 3rd. And early voting begins October 19th through Monday, November 2nd. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten, in part, by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. The Momentary in Bentonville presents the world premiere of The Journey by renowned theater maker and illusionist Scott Sylvan, a live, interactive, and immersive virtual theater experience. Performances now through October 18th. Tickets and information available at themomentary.org.
Welcome to the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report. I'm Paul Gatling. There's a neat story up on our website this week. The sons of Walmart president and CEO Doug McMillon are in the very early stages of introducing a new hospitality concept to downtown Bentonville. It's called Urban Share and is marketed as an alternative to hotels for business travelers. Spencer McMillon is the founder and CEO, and Blake McMillon is the chief operating officer. Now, I asked Spencer McMillon for an interview about the idea, but he politely deferred that until a later date. So we'll check back again at a later date. Again, it's in the very early stages. What we do know is that Urban Share has plans to develop a location in Bentonville by 2021 and another in Seattle in 2022. In Bentonville, the site is near the Thaden School, and Urban Share recently acquired the land for about $1.5 million. You'll find more details about Urban Share in a story on our website at nwabusinessjournal.com. After a quick break, we'll check in with University of Arkansas economist Mervin Jebaraj to discuss the state's rising unemployment and the state and national struggles of the travel and tourism sector. You're listening to the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report.
Support for the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report is provided by the Arkansas State Chamber of Commerce and Associated Industries of Arkansas. The Chamber's mission is to promote a pro-business, free enterprise agenda and prevent legislation, regulation, and rules that hinder business. ArkansasStateChamber.com. Arkansas Blue Cross and Blue Shield. For more than 70 years, Arkansas Blue Cross and Blue Shield has used its knowledge and compassion to create healthcare solutions for individuals and businesses. ArkansasBlueCross.com. First Security is proud to be only in Arkansas. They offer smart solutions for personal and business banking, plus convenient services and community investment. First Security. Member FDIC. Equal housing lender.
The unemployment rate in Arkansas in August was up slightly to 7.4%. University of Arkansas economist Mervin Jebaraj was a guest of Roby Brock on a recent episode of Talk Business and Politics. He shared his thoughts on the latest unemployment numbers and the continued struggles of the travel and tourism sector.
So, yes, yeah, the unemployment rate ticked up ever so slightly in August, and I think, you know, that is a concern, obviously, considering at the beginning of this year we were at 3.5% unemployment rate, and now we're at 7-something, and we seem to be stabilizing around that rate is a bit of a concern for us all. I think it's important to note, though, that, you know, the first month that we saw the unemployment rate go up in April and a little bit in March as well, and then in May, the unemployment rate went up and the labor force participation went down significantly in May and June. You know, in May we saw the unemployment rate go down, the labor force improved, so more people came back looking for work and found work, which is why the unemployment rate went down. In June and July, the unemployment rate continued to go down, but people left the labor force. So a lot of people that came back into the labor force in May did not find work and left the labor force in June and July. And that actually reversed in August, which is why the unemployment rate went up. So more people came into the labor force looking for work. A lot of them did end up finding work. Some of them are still unemployed. So the unemployment rate ticked up. So if there's ever a good reason for the unemployment rate to go up in this particular climate, it's because the labor force actually increased. The number of people looking for work increased. The last couple of months when the unemployment rate went down, it was for bad reasons because people left the labor force. So even though the unemployment rate ticked up slightly, it's still, you know, generally positive given the current circumstances because more people came back into the labor force and are looking for work in the month of August. Now, whether or not this is good or bad long term, I think the issue we have is that, you know, we've seen an improvement in the unemployment rate, but it looks like we might stabilize at a higher rate of unemployment. You know, we lost something like 120,000 jobs in April compared to February this year, and now we're still down about 45,000-50,000 jobs in the state. The problem is that we've remained at that level for a little bit now, and so we need to get those jobs back. And the longer this goes on, it becomes harder for us to get those jobs back. And so that's where my concerns are at this moment.
Now, we're seeing the potential for more layoffs, and they seem to be in the tourism and travel industry, as you and I have discussed previously. Disney making major layoffs, airlines suggesting that big layoffs are about to occur. Is this just going to have to be a correction to the economy, or can the industry be largely saved?
Yeah, we cannot afford that as a correction to our economy. There are a lot of jobs in the leisure and hospitality industry. A lot of people's livelihoods depend on that particular industry. That has been an area of growth between 2010 and 2019 here in Arkansas. So a lot of jobs were created in that particular industry. In Arkansas, at the peak of this, we lost about 40,000 jobs in that particular industry. We're still down about 17,000 to 18,000 jobs in the leisure and hospitality industry. That doesn't mean that all of those people that came back between 40,000 and 17,000 necessarily are working at their same previous job at the same salary or hourly wage or the same number of hours. By and large, people that have come back are working fewer hours and they're taking home less money today than they were before this pandemic and the recession hit. So even the people that got their jobs back are still struggling. In addition to the fact that a lot of jobs have not come back, we're seeing small businesses, especially those in this industry, starting to close and close permanently. The ones that have reopened, especially restaurants and bars, are sometimes closing at least once a month for several days. And so their employees are struggling. Those businesses are struggling because, again, when somebody tests positive in their workplace, they're having to close the entire place down for a couple of days until everybody can get tested. So there is a lot of hurt for this particular industry, and is absolutely imperative that Congress, before doing anything else, really get another stimulus bill up and running. You know, there was a lot of talk, a lot of heat and no action in early August with some talk about a stimulus bill. Since then, that talk has cooled off, but we can't let that be. We really do need another stimulus bill. We need additional money, especially PPP loans targeted to the leisure and hospitality industry, targeted to small businesses in this industry, and we'll need to renew the bailouts that we did provide to larger industries like airlines and hotels and, extend lines of credit to Disney and so on and so forth. So in addition to all of that, we'll still need to extend unemployment benefits. There was a small extension in unemployment benefits using FEMA money that's about to be exhausted if it hasn't been exhausted already. Again, that didn't cover everyone as well. So there's a lot of work left to be done. We obviously haven't gotten control of the pandemic yet, but we really need to save these companies with congressional action.
And that's Mervyn Jebaraj, an economist and the director of the Center for Business and Economic Research at the University of Arkansas. There is more of that interview with Roby Brock at talkbusiness.net. In other news this week, personal income between July and August declined 2.7%, even as Americans increased their spending in certain sectors, including movie theaters, museums, and campgrounds. That's according to the Bureau of Economic Analysis. And Walmart held its annual open call event this week, a virtual event due to the pandemic, of course. The company says it approved products from more than 175 entrepreneurs to move on to the next stage in the process to land their products on Walmart shelves. Another 450 are under further consideration. And more Northwest Arkansas travelers booked flights with Northwest Arkansas National Airport last year instead of opting to fly from other airports in the region. According to a new study, airport officials attributed the increase to leisure travelers taking advantage of lower fares. For those stories and more, visit nwabusinessjournal.com, where you'll find our reporting on the latest business headlines each and every day. I'm Paul Gatling, and that's the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report. Until next time, thanks for listening.
The first Arkansas chapter of the United Daughters of the Confederacy was chartered in 1896 in the City of Hope. Eventually, there would be more than 100 chapters across the state. In 2020, there are 22 chapters of the organization in Arkansas, as well as an overall state organization called the Arkansas Division of the UDC, which was formed in the 1950s. Ozarks at Large's Zuzana Sitek recently spoke with two students at the University of Arkansas who are examining the legacy of UDC chapters in the region. Madison Whipple is working on an undergraduate thesis about Fayetteville's UDC chapter, while Katie Powell, who you'll hear from first, is a doctoral student in the English department researching the language and rhetoric used by the James H. Berry chapter of the UDC in Bentonville.
Yeah, so I think for me, what drew me to the field, and I'm English, but my emphasis is rhetoric and composition, so it's the ways that we communicate. And so I think the connection there is that I'm primarily interested in the legacy that's left behind. And I found that most of that has come through the words of the women. So my research started with the words that are literally and physically on the plaques that we see. So like carved in stone on the statues and monuments around the country or in this region. But then as I got into our special collections and started trying to see what the women chose to leave behind or what their families left behind for them and trusted an institution to preserve, I started really identifying what I call, and I know a lot of people call, the ephemera. So kind of just this extra stuff that we don't ever think about leaving behind that really tells a lot about our values. So like the Book of Minutes is one that I have examined really closely. It's the chapter's minutes book. And so just sharing all of their agenda items and their day-to-day experiences, I think really tells us a lot about their values. And so for me, and I'm not a historian, so I don't know if I'm saying this correctly, but I think for me, I really like the freedom that presents me and that I can focus on the language and the legacy and maybe not as much on the chronology, which again, might just be my misunderstanding of the study of history, but the chronology or even the complete picture in that moment. It can really just kind of focus on these pieces of things that didn't feel important at the time, but clearly I think are able to carve a way for me to see the values and the path that these women had.
And in this case, you're looking at the ephemera left behind by a few women specifically who are prominent in Bentonville. Can you tell us who those women were?
Oh, sure. Yeah. So it's the Berry, Dickinson, and Peels. So the Berries, as you might imagine, are connected to James H. Berry, who the chapter was named after, and was also the 14th governor of Arkansas and a Civil War soldier himself, a Confederate soldier, excuse me. So they're sort of the foundation family that I'm looking at, which is the Berries and their descendants. Through marriage, Barry's wife, as well, excuse me, James H. Barry's wife, and just other marriages within the family. We also got added the Dickinsons and the Peels. And so those are the three families that I'm focusing primarily on. I've kind of loosely tried to construct a family tree for them. But the files for sure all kind of tie back to James H. Barry as that root in the family.
So for context, the Civil War ended in 1865. So what generation are these women in relation to the soldiers who fought in the war?
That's a good question, because a lot of the, at least nationally, the UDC women were mostly, I think, granddaughters of some of these. So their mothers had really established this kind of veneration for the women of the 60s, which we always think of the 60s and 1960. I'm talking about the 1860s, of course. But those women, and again, this is kind of where the martyrdom, I think, comes in, were really heavily, like superfluously remembered by the men as well as by their daughters as these just amazingly powerful, selfless women, which I'm sure a lot of them did very heroic acts to keep their men and their communities intact during wartime. But that's kind of the legacy that I think the granddaughters were given in sort of. So my interpretation is that the daughters of those women kind of founded the Ladies Memorial Associations, which were very much about actual Confederate dead, and then their granddaughters, and then moving forward, were more about establishing this Confederate legacy.
And Maddie, you're focusing on the Mildred Lee chapter of the UDC, which was here in Fayetteville. So who are the women that you're looking into?
So I'm really studying women who were involved with the university, white, prominent, usually married. But there's a lot of also mothers and daughters that were in the UDC in Fayetteville. And so those daughters were involved in the university in the way that they were in sororities or other, like the home economics club. A lot of them were involved in that. And so I'm really just looking at women whose stories line up kind of with prominent people at the university. So there's Dr. Futrell. She was the first full-time professor at the university. Futrell Hall is named after her. She was a prominent member of the UDC during her time. And so, yeah, I'm really just looking for those connections in any way that they're influenced by or the university is influenced by them.
I'm going to jump back to you, Katie. How does the language the women of the UDC were using play into what they were doing in the early 1900s? And what impact does it have on us now in 2020?
Yeah, I think there's a real rhetoric around kind of venerating the men that they lost in the Civil War, which of course, as most people probably have figured out or assumed, that was the founding of the UDC was really built or established from the Ladies Memorials Associations, which happened right after the Civil War. And then this, what we're talking about now is at least 30 years after the Civil War. So many of the women may have distantly known veterans or people who had passed away, but they're, the language that they're using is really all around those men of the Confederacy. But there's a lot of kind of, I would call it martyrdom in that. There's a lot of kind of sharing a story that maybe they feel like didn't get to be exposed or didn't get to be shared and honored. And so I think the martyrdom that I see like in their minutes and in some of their rituals suggests that, sort of paves the way for what I think we see. And maybe this is where I think Maddie could really pick up in kind of the revising of history that they do through the memory that they have of these men, the way that they remember the time before the Civil War, and the way that they appear, and I've seen this through some newspaper clippings that they chose to save and presentations that they do in their minutes chapters, but kind of the way they choose to interpret more contemporary movements, such as the Civil Rights Movement in the 60s. And so I've seen some really interesting examples there of their conflicting worldviews, I guess, coming in as you start trying to put these values that they have from the Confederacy on the present day. So yeah, really kind of a veneration or a martyrdom that I think we see play out as they go through history. And I don't know, Maddie, if that is something that you've discovered or if that kind of leads into probably what you've noticed and the way they educate too.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's really like what I'm looking into as far as my thesis goes. I liked what you said about the language, Katie. Like, they're very much trying to establish the fact that like they're venerating these people, and then they're trying to change the language as it comes to like history. And they just really are into the revisionist side of history. And so I think that the best anecdote so far that I have is that there is a professor at the university who wrote a textbook financed by the UDC, and he wrote it for Arkansas Public Schools. And so it was kind of a this veneration martyrdom twist on who the Southern men were, who the plantation owners were, who the slaves were. Really puts a twist on a lot of that. And then even following the Civil War, Reconstruction eras, like you said, Katie, like they're trying to apply their values to what happened even after the Civil War. So, yeah.
And especially recently with what's been happening across the country, it seems like the language the UDC injected into society in general and into education is something that we're still grappling with today.
Yeah, I think that that's like what I have realized over this summer as well, is just it's a legacy that there's people who are alive still who learned this in school. I mean, the integration of schools was not that long ago. My grandparents were in school when it happened. And so I think that it's really grappling with the fact that we have to unlearn, even us as like millennials, Gen Zers, like we have to unlearn what we've been taught by people who were taught with this language and that sort of education. So, yeah.
And what about you, Katie?
So one of the areas that I think I found that most clearly is in the debates around the removal or the keeping of the Bentonville Confederate Monument. So the petitions to keep the statue where it was had a lot of the same overall kind of languages and themes that we see in these books of minutes, in the Confederate prayer, you know, in a lot of the rituals that the women performed. And so one of those, of course, is an emphasis on ancestors. And so I saw a lot of emphasis on ancestorship. Another one is this really kind of clear connection to place and hospitality in place. And I think I saw that in the petitions to keep, which those started in, I think I'm going to get this wrong, either 2016 or 2017, but very, I mean, that was
around that time. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. So we're talking under 5 years ago that this, the same language was used around, what a great and amazing place Bentonville is, and that this is part of that history. And so connecting those two is very similar to what we see in the archives that the women left behind, which I think really shows that even if it's unconsciously, that through line is still very much there, which like Maddie said, is why I think it's so important to engage in it. And it's something for me, and I think Maddie might say this too, I identify as a white woman. And so I reaching into what I'm terming my community ancestors and trying to read into those people and into those women is so important to help us kind of start dismantling that through line and really at least recognizing where we're getting this language. And like you said, Maddie, having to unlearn it in order to kind of imagine a better community, I think is really critical, even if it's not always fun.
Yeah.
So Maddie, since you're looking at the Fayetteville UDC specifically at a time when I think the city sees itself as a progressive place, what would you like the people living here to know about a history that maybe isn't as obvious as it is in Bentonville, or at least as it was in Bentonville up until last month when that Confederate monument was removed?
Yeah, I think that probably one of the more shocking things that I've come across, and I don't know why I was surprised by this necessarily, but the fact that there were so many powerful men whose wives, powerful men at the university whose wives were UDC members and who were perpetuating this, not only the Confederate lost cause, but they were perpetuating like Fayetteville being involved in the lost cause, and like Fayetteville's really proud history in the Confederacy, especially as it relates to like the Prairie Grove battle and stuff like that, and locals who were in the Confederacy. So yeah, I think just like the fact that Fayettevillians don't really recognize that like maybe like Futrell Hall was named after someone who was maybe a little bit problematic, or that they have upkept the Confederate cemetery here for years and years. It's just something that kind of is an undercurrent and is not necessarily as visible as it is in Bentonville. But it's still a history that we just kind of accept and haven't really paid attention to because it's not right in front of us, I guess.
It also sounds like the UDC is one of the few places women were in charge at a time when women weren't in charge of a whole lot of things. So did that play into the power of the UDC, that it was one of the few spaces women really had a say in how things were done?
Yeah, I think it definitely made a difference in the force that they used. And this is just me kind of reading between the lines of history. So I haven't actually fact-checked this with scholars or anything. But I really see, and just trying to, again, imagine myself in those spaces, if that's the one area of power that you're given, really using it to make the most of whatever the cause is, even if at some point I think they had to have stopped. Like the last entry in the Book of Minutes that I read is about how there are no more existing or living Confederate veterans, which was the whole purpose of the organization. And so they were sort of spinning in this meeting what they were going to do now. And so I think that in itself to me speaks to this need that they had for a space and a place for power. I think also the fundraising that we saw for the statue, as well as many other programs and events, there's a lot of kind of real pressure that they put on their men. Some might call it bullying to make sure that the money got raised the way that they wanted it to. And so I definitely think that it's no coincidence that that was kind of coming alongside the same women's, you know, suffragist movement in order to find a place to kind of exert power within the world and within kind of the gender roles that they were expected to perform.
So what are you hoping people take away from this kind of research?
I think for me, the number one thing I hope people take away is that this isn't over because the statue's gone. I think that's the number one thing that I started this research before it really got big, and then when the monument got moved, and it's all very exciting. But I think that's the number one, that this statue being gone doesn't mean there's not a lot of work we have to do as a community. And so for me, the answer in that comes in engaging with these women and the legacy that they've left us. And so, I think that that's my biggest takeaway, is just the importance of engaging and really critically examining not just the physical areas of our community, but the unspoken areas of our community, and who, for me as a white woman, how I'm perpetuating that so that I can help other people, particularly for me, other white women, learn how to kind of dismantle that.
For me, you said this earlier, but Fayetteville prides itself as a very progressive place. And I think that this summer started conversations not only over the racial inequities that Fayetteville has in the present day and in history, but also, I mean, there's been a lot of conversation about Senator Fulbright. There's been a lot of conversation about surrounding the people who we venerate at this university, and that maybe we need to, I don't know, bring some sort of awareness to the fact that maybe we need to have a conversation about what this history has led us to. And I think that, Katie, like what you said about language is super powerful, because that language carries into today. And so having this awareness and bringing some sort of light to the UDC and their history and how they've influenced the university is important in dismantling what they've built.
Thank you both for speaking with us about this.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having us on.
That was Madison Whipple, an undergrad at the University of Arkansas, and U of A doctoral student Katie Powell speaking with Ozarks at Large's Zuzana Sitek about the research they're conducting into the local chapters of the United Daughters of the Confederacy.
This is Leah Uribe, Associate Professor at the University of Arkansas Music Department, expanding our musical boundaries with sound perimeter. The weather is so nice outside, perfect for hiking, running, doing yoga in the park, riding a bike. I've never been really into biking. In fact, for reasons I prefer not to disclose, I didn't learn how to ride a bike until I was 18 years old. But I vividly remember childhood dreams of riding bikes, the sun kissing my face, the wind messing with my hair, you know, that freedom experience I hear bikers have when on the road. Bicycles have been inspiration for many composers and songwriters. We open Sound Perimeter with a rather unusual piece by avant-garde Argentinian composer Mauricio Kagel. Ay Nebris, A Breeze, is a performance piece for 111 cyclists. Participants follow precise choreography while riding, accompanied by rattling sounds, whispers, and recited sentences. This work was premiered on May 29th of the year 2000 in Glasgow, Scotland. The composer placed recording devices directly onto the bikes to capture the sounds that would then become the melody. In this work, the bikes and the bikers are the instruments. Rican composer Angélica Negrón wrote La Bicicleta de Cristal, Glass Bicycle, inspired by the image of a glass bicycle you could take anywhere you wanted, something that would allow you to move freely without thinking of borders or boundaries. In the early 1900s, during the fight to win the right to vote, the bicycle became not only a tool but also a symbol for the emancipation of women. Perhaps composer Negrón was thinking about the glass bike that breaks the glass ceiling. Here it is an excerpt from Angélica Negrón's La Bicicleta de Cristal, performed by percussionist Colleen Bernstein. Thank you. We close Sound Perimeter today with the happy song by Colombian artist Shakira and Carlos Vives, La Bicicleta, The Bicycle. La Bicicleta is a song that mixes Colombian genres like vallenato and cumbia with pop and reggaeton and features flautas de millo, indigenous Colombian wind instruments, and the accordion, among other indigenous and local instruments. The words are nostalgic, describing Shakira's and Carlos Vives' excursions on bikes to their childhood places.
Que te lleve a todos lados.
Un vallenato desesperado.
Una cartica que yo guardo donde te escribí. Que te sueñe, que te quiero tanto. Que hace rato está mi corazón latiendo por ti, latiendo por ti. La que yo guardo donde te escribí. Que te sueñe, que te quiero tanto. Que hace rato está mi corazón latiendo por ti, latiendo por ti.
Today we took a tour in our bikes, and it was a cool ride. Thank you for listening. This is Leah Uribe, Associate Professor at the University of Arkansas Music Department, expanding our musical boundaries with Sound Perimeter.
Walton Arts Center presents Saturday Cinema this Saturday, featuring Zarafa at 2 p.m. in Baum Walker Hall. And 42nd Street, captured live from the London stage this Saturday evening at 7. Tickets and more information at waltonartscenter.org. The Shiloh Museum of Ozark History is open Monday through Friday, 10 a.m. to 5 p.m., and 10 a.m. to noon each Thursday for high-risk guests. COVID safety procedures are in place. The museum also offers a number of online resources for exploring Arkansas Ozark history. 750-8165 or shilohmuseum.org for more information.
This is 91.3 FM KUAF in Fayetteville, Rogers, Fort Smith, Bentonville, a listener-supported service of the University of Arkansas. Contributors today included Jacqueline Froelich and Zuzana Sitek. We also heard from Paul Gatling from the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal, and Leah Uribe voiced this week's Sound Perimeter, which was produced by Lee Wood. Timothy Dennis mixed and mastered today's show, and our theme song is written and performed by Daryl Sean. If you've missed an episode of the show this week and you would like to hear it, or if you just want to listen to a story again or share it with a friend, you can find those past stories and episodes of our program at ozarksatlarge.com. You can also listen to our show as a podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Thanks so much for listening, and have a wonderful rest of your Thursday.